Hi, I'm Marita Litauer. For more than 35 years, my mother, Florence Litauer, traversed the globe sharing her message of hope, encouragement, and understanding. Many people remember Florence Litauer for her signature speech on silver boxes, The Gift of Encouragement, and her popular book by the same name. Her masterful application of the Bible verse, Ephesians 4:29, brought home the reality of the power our words have upon others and the effect we allow others' words to have over our own lives. Many people have shared that this important message changed them and empowered them to become encouragers. It has even been known to bring tears to the eyes of corporate CEOs. In fact, just days before recording this greeting, I received a Facebook post from someone in Hungary telling me that years later, my mother's silver box message was still having an impact on her life. Florence Litauer's work has had a positive influence on an infinite number of people. Florence died knowing that she has made the world a better place. Though she is no longer with us in person, her influence, with your help, will continue to live on. Assuming you find Silver Boxes, The Gift of Encouragement, to be as powerful as past audiences, please share the link to this presentation with everyone you know.
It was several years ago that I was sitting in a church audience, as you are tonight, and I was sitting there just as an attendee that morning. I was speaking, doing our class for the next 3 days there, training their leadership, and so I was there that morning, relaxed. The pastor looked out. He saw me out there, and he pointed me out. He said, I see that Florence Litauer is here this morning. Why don't we have her come up and say a few words? Now, how would you feel if on Sunday morning you were called up to say a few words? Well, it's no problem for me to say a few words. In fact, a few words is harder than many words. So I started up the aisle, and I thought to myself, now, what will I say? What's he going to ask me? What does he want? What should I say? So this is going through my head very fast when the pastor gets a better idea. He said, in fact, why don't we have Florence do the children's sermon? Now, I had never done a children's sermon. I had somehow not felt called to children. And so I had to shoot up an emergency prayer. Do you ever do those? An emergency prayer says, Lord, I need a children's sermon. I need it right now. Tomorrow will be too late. And as I came out with that, a verse went through my mind. Now, it's very hard for a verse to go through your mind if you've never put any up there. But if you have, and you've got some verses up there, then you can pull one out. So as I prayed, Lord, give me a verse, he gave me immediately Ephesians 4:29. And I ran it through fast through my mind. Let no corrupt communication proceed. I mean, oh, good to the minister of grace. Here. No, I rejected it. I said, no, Lord. I said, that one is too long, too hard. They'll never get it. But by then, I was up front. And all the children were sitting here in these front rows. And as I looked down at them, I had nothing to say to them but one verse. What can you do with one verse? It's amazing what we can do with one verse. So I looked at them and I said, how would you like to learn one verse today? Because any time we look at Scripture, we have to ask ourselves, what does it say? What does it mean? And how does it apply to me today? So I said, I'm going to show you first place what it says. Then together we're going to figure out what it means and therefore how it applies to me today. The verse is Ephesians 4:29. I'm going to give it to you and you listen. Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good. Good to the use of edifying, that it might minister grace unto the hearers. Now, by the time I finished that, their confidence level had dropped. And they were looking at me as if, who in the world could ever understand that? I said, now I know it sounds a little difficult, but what we're going to do is take it apart. And when we take it apart, we'll find out what it means. So let's start with a word you all know, mouth. Do you all know what a mouth is? Oh, yes, they nodded. They knew a mouth. I said, now what this is talking about is what comes out of our mouth. And the word they use of what comes out of our mouth is communication. Now, what does communication mean? Well, some of them called out, talking, talking. I said, that's right. Communication is talking. But there is a little difference. Because you see, when you go, you could go into, let's say, a closet. And you could stand into a closet. You could shut the door behind you. And you could stand in there and you could talk all afternoon. But would anybody hear you? Would anybody know that you were talking? You see, there's a difference between talking and communicating. Because in communicating, it comes out of my mouth into your ear, out of your mouth into my ear. And as you talk to me and I listen, and I talk to you and you listen, then we communicate. So do you see the difference between just talking with nobody noticing or caring, or communicating where we share one with another? Well, they nodded. They began to get it. I said, now let's back up a little bit further in the beginning where it says no corrupt communication. Now, what is corrupt communication? So a little boy called out, bad words. I said, that's right. Corrupt communication is bad words. Now, give me an example. I was sorry I asked that. They started giving me bad words. They had not had this much fun in church in many a year. I said, no, I don't want to hear any bad words. I mean, what kinds of things are bad words? Insulting your mother, saying bad things to your father, being nasty to other people. I said, those are all corrupt communication. From here on, you're not going to say any of those things, right? Oh, they nodded. Yes, they're never going to say those things again. So as they nodded, then I said, this is what we're talking about here. That corrupt communication is bad words. And that these bad words come out of our mouth and they hurt other people, upset other people. And we do not come across as pleasant and nice people when we are saying bad words. Well, they were right along with me and they nodded with me. And I said, now we have to back up a little bit further to the beginning, because in the beginning it says, let no bad words come out of my mouth. And if it says, let no bad words come out of my mouth, that means God would not have written that verse and written it that way if I did not have control over those bad words. And so you see, it tells me right here that I have to let no bad words. And I have control over that. I am in a position where, and isn't it clever of God, where God put my mind in first before he put in my mouth. And so when I'm hearing something come through my mind that I know is going to come out of my mouth, I, because that's first, I am able to stop it. I have control over what comes out of my mouth. Now, isn't that good to know? You can't say to somebody, I don't know how it just came out of my mouth. No, it didn't just come out of your mouth. It went through your brain first, then it came out of your mouth. You allowed it to come out, and that's why that verse says, do not let, allow, give permission to any bad words to come out of your mouth. Now, that's what it is that God tells us what not to do. Now, the Bible isn't all what is not to do, because he also tells us what we should do. Because, you see, God never says no, 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 without saying yes, 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 yes. And so he tells us what we should do. We should not let any bad words get out of our mouth. But it says, no, we should only let out good words. Now, isn't it interesting that God gave us a difference between good and bad even when we're little? When we're little tiny, we know the difference between good and bad. I have a little granddaughter, and when she was 3 years old, about a year ago, I was sitting there in their home, and she said something nasty to her mother. And her mother did not get angry, scream, or into rave. She just looked at her and she said, "You may go to your chair now for a while." Now, I didn't know at that point where the chair was, but that was in the dining room all by herself. And so she got up and her little lips sticking out down like this, 3 years old. She's angry at her mother and she marches in there to her chair and she slams herself down in the chair and she sits there for a while. And I said, "What do we do with her?" She said, "You don't do anything with her. You leave her there till she comes back and says she's sorry." So I thought, oh, amazing. So pretty soon the child comes back. The child is now smiling. And she says, "I am very sorry I said bad words." Well, now I was very glad that she knew why she'd been sent there, that she had said some bad words. And then later I was in their house one day and I looked down the hall towards her room and I noticed that she was standing sideways against the wall and she had her head right like this. Just standing there. So I said to my daughter-in-law, "What's she doing now?" She said she's done something wrong and she's giving herself a timeout for punishment before she gets caught. I thought that was good. A good thing to do. But you see, what this means is that you see that even as little children, we know good from bad. And so this verse says to me, let no bad words come out of my mouth and I have control over it, but only let out words that are good versus bad. Now then it goes on to say not only good, but it says good for something. So we've got to figure out our words have got to be good for something. So we should not let any bad words come out of our mouth, only words that are good. Good to the use of edifying. And I said to this group that morning, "What does edifying mean?" And one little child called out and she said, "Building up." I said, "Wonderful. That is great. That's exactly what it means. That when I open my mouth, the words that I let out of my mouth that have gone through my brain and are now up to my mouth, that those words should be good for edifying. Now, what does edifying mean?" So someone else called out and said, "Building up." And I said, "Yes, building up, that is right." Then one little boy called out and he said that our words should be like building blocks. Now, I had really never thought of that before. Actually, I had never thought of this whole message before. And when he said that, I said, "You know, that's right. That's right. That my words, it should not be bad. They should be good. They should build up." And I said, "They should be like building blocks." So I smiled at him. What a good idea. He'd done a good job. And I said, "Should be like building blocks." And so I pretended I had them. And I held up little building blocks. And I said, "My words, when they come out of my mouth, are going to build somebody up, make them feel good." And as I said that, one little girl called out and she said, "And we should not go around and knock other people's piles of blocks down." And I thought, isn't that amazing? How many of us, even children, know that when we let those bad words out, those insults out, those words that knock us down, that it's like a pile of blocks that is knocked down. Now, I began to think of that myself. How many times have I said words to my family that have knocked them down? Not built them up, but knocked them down. So then we moved on to the next part, the end of it, where it says, not only I should not let any bad words come out of my mouth, only good words, words that build up, don't knock down, but that they should minister grace unto the hearers. And I said, what does minister grace mean? Who knows what the word grace means? Well, amazingly, a little girl jumped out in the aisle and she stood right there very stiff and put her hands down like this. And she looked up and she said, "Grace is God's unmerited favor." I looked at her. I was amazed. I said, "That's wonderful." I said, "How do you know that?" She says, "They taught us that in Sunday school." Well, I was very proud of her and I thanked her. I said, "That's very good. Now tell us, what does it mean?" She says, I have no idea. I said, you have no idea what the unmerited favor means? She said, no, they never told us. Now, I don't know whether they told her or not, but the thing was, she knew the answer, but she had no idea what it meant. It made me wonder how many sermons we have heard in our life, how many Bible studies we've been to, how many programs we've attended where Scripture was used, where we heard it and maybe even held the words in our mind, but had never yet applied it to our own life. Sometimes we get the words, but we don't necessarily get the meaning. So when we finished this, I wrapped it up and I said, all right, let's look back at what we've just learned. It's good to review what you've just taught so they get the idea. So I said, now let's start over here. That it tells me I should not allow, give permission to any bad words to come out of my mouth, and I have time to think it over. But that I should not give out words that are bad, but words that are good, words that are good to the use of edifying, building up, not knocking down, ministering grace, doing a favor, being like, and then it came to me, being like a gift. And I thought, that's good. Our words should be like a gift. And as I said that, another little girl stepped out in the aisle of the Sunday morning audience, turned around to the whole church, and said loudly and clearly, what she means is. Now, I think it's very good for all of us speakers to have a child in the audience who will interpret what we said for the other people. So when she said that, the whole audience just gasped because they couldn't believe this little child said that what it means is that our words should be like a gift. And then she added, like a little silver box with a bow on top. Now, when she said that, everybody went, oh. Let me hear you do that. Oh. Now, you see, that's music to a speaker's heart. And you hear that, and so I thought to myself, all right, that is a good expression, that our words should be like a little silver box with a bow on top. So I put that up in my mind. I have columns in my mind where I keep ideas for future speeches and for future books. And so I put that up there. My words should be like a gift, a little silver box with a bow on top. Shortly after that, I was asked to speak at a church in Florida. And I went there, and they had just had what was called a doctrinal split. Now, I have been in many churches that have had doctrinal splits. Usually, it's not doctrine at all. The reason it's not usually a doctrinal split is because most of the people sitting there don't know enough doctrine to split over it. It's not a doctrinal split. What it basically is a personality conflict. Well, they called and asked me if I'd come and speak there, and they wanted to let me know that there was a split down the middle of the church, and Lady A had taught the Bible study for years, and everybody knew that she was God's answer to women, and that she had been giving this message every Thursday morning, and that everybody loved her, and she was the spiritual giant of the church. So now that's Lady A. But along came Lady B, who just moved in there. Lady B didn't know that everybody liked Lady A, and somebody asked her to do a Bible study. She liked doing Bible studies. She used to do them in her other church. And so now she's there. So they set it up and they start a Bible study on Wednesday morning. And she teaches them. Well, now you don't have to have been in any church very long to know that you got two ladies teaching Bible studies. We get a conflict. And it becomes a doctrinal split. Well, they asked me to come and heal the wounds of the church. They gave me 45 minutes on Sunday evening to come and straighten the church out. Well, I came, and sure enough, just as they said, Lady B was on this side, Lady A was on that side, and their little followers were there. And so I took the idea of my words being like a gift, like a little silver box with a bow on top, and I took that idea, and I translated it into their particular set of problems. And when I finished, I thought I'd done a good job. I thought I'd hit it just where I should have done it. And so when I finished, There was just absolute silence. Now, I didn't expect a rousing ovation, but I didn't expect silence either. There was nothing. So I thought, I'll look around to the pastor who's sitting over here. I'll look around to him and see what I'm supposed to do now. So I looked over towards him. He was gone. Somewhere during my talk, he had disappeared. Never to be seen that night. So anyway, I just left the church and no one spoke to me. And I just left. Well, the next night I was speaking to the ladies of the church. And so the next night when I got there, a woman came up to me. And she said to me, I listened to what you had to say last night. And I was in a Christmas tree store today where they had ornaments. And I saw this little silver box. Has a bow on top. And it reminded me of the story you told last night about that we should have our words to be like a gift, like a little silver box with a bow on top. So she said, here, you can have this. Take it home, hang it on your Christmas tree, and every time you walk by, you'll notice that, and you'll remember that your words ought to be like a gift, like a little silver box with a bow on top. Now, this next lady came up to me. Now, this was a very heavy-footed lady. And she came sort of storming up the aisle, and she had this box in her hand, and she said, I listened to what you had to say last night, and I realized I haven't said a nice word to my husband in years. Now, she's got a teenage daughter standing behind her who's looking over her mother's shoulder at me and nodding like, that is for sure. That's for sure. She said, I haven't even said really much nice to my children. The daughter really almost fell over with her mother's newfound discernment. And she said, but last night after I listened to you, I realized what I'd done wrong. And she said, I went out into the garage. I looked around with some old Christmas boxes that were there. I found some silver paper and a bunch of fluffy stuff here. She said, I kind of stuck it all together. And I made about a few of these. And I've stuck one of these in every room in my house. And she said, now, no matter what room I go into, I will see the silver box with the bow on top, and I will know that my words ought to be like a gift, like a little silver box with a bow on top. Now, I found out that even though they had not been responsive the night before, they had been so guilt-stricken on what they had done and how they'd behaved, that by the next night, they were really nice and were applying the lesson to their own lives. Now, that gave me a feeling that this idea that my words should be like a gift, like a little silver box with a bow on top, really would make a difference. And so I began to think, what could I do with that so that I could make this into a generic lesson for everybody? The first thing I always do when I'm putting together a message, whether it's in a book or whether it is in speaking, that I always think, how do I do? And I hope that all of you who do any teaching of any type, that you think about it and say, how do I do on this? Because you see, my husband and I agree that we were not going to teach anything that we had not run through in our own lives and found how it worked. So I had to think it over myself. And I realized that Fred and I, while we'd had some difficulties early on in our marriage, that we had worked out some of the problems and that we were doing pretty well together. Then I thought about my oldest daughter, Lauren. Now, Lauren was always the good one. Now, think about your family. Isn't there one of your children that has always been the good one? And you have sighed over that child. Well, I used to look at Lauren, and then I would look at the children of some of my friends. Now, you've done this for sure. And those children, they're really terrible. They have no manners. They don't know what they should be doing. And they run all over, and they could ruin your house in no time. So I must tell you that I looked down upon such mothers. I looked down upon them and thought to myself, why don't they control these children? Now, I was able to have that superior attitude for 4 years. I had it for 4 years, and then I had Marita. Now, a lot of you know Marita. Now, when she was little, it was like with Lauren, I would say, go to the right, she'd do it. With Marita, I'd say, go to the right, she'd go left. I'd say, go up, she'd go down. Whatever I asked her to do, she would look at me with a devilish twinkle and do just the opposite all the time. She sat in her crib, and I had decorated her room perfectly because I was the perfect mother. And so I had the room all decorated, and she would sit in her crib. 6 months old, she'd sit there, and there were little seams where the wallpaper met, and she could get her little tiny finger into that. And by the time I'd go in the morning, she would have the bed already full of scraps of wallpaper. Now, no matter how I tried to teach her not to rip the wallpaper off the wall, she would still do it and giggle when I'd come in and say, "Oh my, you've done it again." Well, I had to eat my words with her. I remember one day she stole money out of my wallet, and she went down the hill to the little florist shops there. She was just a little kid, and she bought me a geranium. I've always liked geraniums because she brought me this geranium. She brought it up to me. She handed it to me. And I said, "Thank you. Where did you get the money?" And she was always honest about being crooked. And so she said right off, she said, "Out of your wallet." Now, I know that all of you fine Christian mothers, I know what you would have done with this. But instead, I smiled and I thanked her for the geranium that she had bought with my money. Now, you see, I had these two children. I had the good one and the bad one. Now, why wasn't I unhappy with the bad one? Because the bad one was funny. And I've always found I would rather have a bad child who's funny than a good one who's dull. Well, I looked this over, and I decided I had done pretty well with both of them one way or another. And then I had a little adopted son, Fred. Many of you know my life story and know that I gave birth to two sons after my two girls, both of whom were fatally brain damaged. And I had to face the fact that wonderful me, great mother that I was, big house that I had, leader of the community that I was, that I had to realize that there was something in life, two things in life that I could not control. And I had gotten to a point where I realized finally that I was not the great controller of life. And I remember as that second child was diagnosed the same way, and I had to put him into a children's hospital where he stayed until he was 19 years old and died at that age, same size he was at 1 year old. Now, for me, this was a tragedy. It would be for anyone. But for me, who had thought myself to be the great mother with the great house and the good cars and the handsome husband and all the things that I had reviewed in my mind that I was so good at and so proficient at, and I had to admit to myself that I had now a second problem on my hand over which I had absolutely no control. It was at this point, during this period of time, that I went to a Christian women's club with my sister-in-law, and I prayed on the verses Romans 12, 1 and 2, "Present your body, not just a little of you, but all of you. Present your body as a living sacrifice." Give yourself up to God. "Present yourself as a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto him, which is your reasonable service. And be not conformed to the world." And it was at that point that I realized I had been conformed to the world. I had spent all my time trying to have the biggest house and the best cars and have everybody know me and have the best clothes and be the head of the modeling and be the president of the Women's League of Women Voters and all these things that I was that were important things. But when I saw that verse, and it's amazing how one verse can speak to you and change your mind, this one verse said, "Be not conformed to the world. Do not fit into the mold of the world. Do not try to be like the world. Do not try to be worldly." Well, I knew I had done all those things. And so when that minister that day, after I had not gone to church for 2 years and had given up on God, that minister that day led me to the Lord. And as he finished that, present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto him, which is your reasonable service. Be not conformed to the world, but be transformed, changed, made over by the renewing of your mind. And then someday you will know, after you've done this, you will know what is that good, acceptable, and perfect will of God for you. Well, that day I committed my life to the Lord, and I began to look at my life differently. I began to look at it as what was the Lord asking me to do with my set of circumstances. We adopted a little boy, little three-month-old baby, Fred, and brought him into our home. And for the first time, we had a really Christian home. We began to attend a little church that was in our area, sort of a new church. And we became immediately people of some leadership in the church. And Fred and I had gone from not knowing the Lord in any way at all to pretty much running a church. Now, we looked at that and we saw how our lives had changed and what differences there were. Now, at that time, as I was looking our family over and evaluating us, as I was doing that, I can remember thinking to myself, we've done pretty well. Fred and I have straightened ourselves out. Lauren is on her way growing up. Marita is still fun and has stopped doing some of the crazy things she had done in the past. And now I have this little son. And at the time I was talking about this to myself, he was a teenager. And I remember as I got a phone call asking me to come to speak with a traveling group from the First Baptist Church in Dallas and to go to Europe for 2 weeks and the Holy Land for 1 week and to travel with this group of people. And I would speak every other night to the group and I could bring one person with me. Well, I thought of my husband, but his business was too much. He couldn't go. I thought of Lauren, but she just got married. She couldn't go. I thought of Marita, and she was engaged in getting married. She couldn't go. And so what did this run me down to? This ran me down to my son, Fred, deeply melancholy, and my son, Fred, who didn't really even like me. Now, I hate to say that, but we have to be honest when we look back, don't we? I mean, haven't you got one of your children that still doesn't like you? And you don't know why, because you're such a great person. But somehow this child is none like you. And I can remember one day when Fred was having some friends over, and he said to me, when Mrs. Carpentiero comes to pick them up at 5 o'clock, would you go to your room and shut the door? Now, I'm sure most of you would have said, what do you mean, telling his mother that? But instead, because I'm the actress type here, I said to him, oh, Fred, I'll be nice to Mrs. Carpentiero. I'll stand in the corner. I'll pretend I'm a tree. Now, he looked at me, and he said to me, see, that's what I don't like about you. You think you're funny. And on that, I said, I'll go to my room. So I did. I went to my room. I shut the door. The lady came. She picked up these children. She left. He came. He knocked on the door. He said, you can come out now. Now, this was a boy with no sense of humor whatsoever. And he didn't think I was funny. And so I came out. And he said, thank you very much. I appreciate that you helped me out. Now, see, he was afraid of me. He was afraid that I would say something that would offend this lady. I don't know why I'd ever think that I'd say something without thinking, but that was his concern. And so he thanked me for helping him. Well, he and I really didn't have much in common. I tried every way. He didn't like my humor. He didn't like my style. He didn't like what I did. He didn't like much of anything. And we just kind of parted our ways. And we would speak when we had to, but we wouldn't do too much the rest of the time. Now, if you've got a child like this, I'll tell you what happened in my situation. Because I got this opportunity to go to Europe. And I'd gone down through the whole family of who could go. No one could go. And I got down to young Fred. I prayed about this. I said, Lord, you know he doesn't like me. You know that I really don't want to take him to Europe. However, no one else can go. And now, would you just tell me whether you want me to take him to Europe or not? Now, I waited about 30 seconds for the Lord to speak to me. He didn't say anything right off, so I assumed that meant I shouldn't take him. So, however, it kept gnawing on me. Has that ever happened to you? You've decided, no, the Lord does not want me to do this. And then everywhere you turn, you hear, do it, go, go. And after a while, you get sick of hearing it. You think, maybe I ought to test it out again. And so one day he was standing in the kitchen. He used to stand in the kitchen. He's an early teen at this point. And with the door of the refrigerator and the freezer, both the doors open. And I would walk in and he'd be standing there staring into the space of the refrigerator. I would look at this. Well, that's what he was doing that day. And I said, Fred, I have something to ask you. He looked at me like he'd never seen me before. He looked me over here, and he said, what is it? And he leaned on the counter. So I leaned on the other counter. We looked at each other. And I said, Fred, I've got this perfectly dreadful trip I'm going to have to take to Europe. It's going to be no fun. It's going to be all work. And I thought I'd ask you if there's any chance you might like to go along, miserable though the trip will be, that, and you could, I have to speak a lot on it, you'd have to pass out the outlines. And I gave him this whole list. I made that trip sound so dreadful, there's not one of you would have gone with me. But what I forgot is my son is melancholy, and he likes bad news. So I stood up, and he looked at me, and he smiled. And he said, that would be just great. So that was the beginning of the trip. And so then I got all the things ready, and we didn't talk about it again. But we got ready, and we went. So we went on the trip. Now, the whole trip, I had prayed about it a lot, but the whole trip was a lot easier than I had anticipated because my son slept through most of Europe. Have you ever taken a teenager on a wonderful experience, a great trip, and they slept through it to let you know what they thought of it? Well, he slept through Europe. I woke him up. Wake up, Fred. These are the Alps. He looked out the window, down the front, across this, down here. Back to sleep. I said, Fred, these are the Alps. He said, I know, I just saw them. I found out that with my son, you've seen one mountain, you've seen them all. I woke him up at St. Paul's Cathedral. Wake up, Fred, we're going through another cathedral. He just quietly said, I don't wish to see another cathedral. Do you know what came to my mouth to say? And this is why I know it comes through your mind before it comes out your mouth. Because this whole thing went through my mind. I didn't ask you, Fred, if you wanted to go through another cathedral. I just told you, get out of this bus. March through that cathedral. And don't you know how much it costs me to bring you here? And the more cathedrals you march through, the cheaper it is per capita per cathedral for me. All of that went through my mind. But I swallowed. Swallowing is good. So I swallowed and I said, that's fine, Fred. Stay in the bus. I'll bring you back a brochure. I brought my son back brochures from some of the finest places in Europe that he never did see. I made him a scrapbook and I put all of these in it. And I labeled it places I never saw. Now, on that trip, there was a girl who liked my son. My son is very handsome and very quiet, so strong-minded girls like him. So this girl came over to me one day, and she said to me, your son really loves you. Well, that was good news to me. And I said, tell me about it. She said, well, yesterday on the bus, you fell asleep. Now, this girl had a camera. She was always taking pictures. But she I didn't like her much because she took pictures of me. Now, I teach you, when you come to class, I teach you how to stand in pictures. I picture that you got to stand like this, sideways. You got to put all your weight on the back leg. It takes 10 pounds off right here. Now, see, when you stand like that, you will always look better when the picture comes out than the poor little chubby lady next to you who's just standing there. One lady came up to me once and she said, I heard you speak 5 years ago, and the only thing I really remember is how to stand in pictures. Anyway, this girl said, she said, your son really loves you. Yesterday you were sitting on the bus. She said, you had your head against the window and your mouth was hanging open. She said, you looked real weird. She said, so I got my camera out and got ready to take a picture of you. And she said, just as I was going to take your picture, your son moved his body in front of you and said, what are you planning to do? Because I told him that I'm going to take a picture of your mother looking funny like that. And she said, he looked at me and said, from here on, you'll take no more pictures of my mother without asking her permission first. And then she said, your son really loves you. Well, I found out that while he didn't like me a lot awake, he really cared for me when I was asleep. Now, we went through that trip, and the last night as we stood in the Jerusalem Hilton and looked out over that scene, and I wanted to talk with him. And I knew if I were with Lauren, she'd be directing me up and down every street and alley, every tower and turret, every castle and cathedral. We'd be going through everything to the end. If I were with Marita, we'd be standing there laughing about all the funny people that were on the trip with us. And aren't they an amazing group? And so, but instead, I was with young Fred. He hadn't said a word to me in a half hour. So I just stood there, and I just determined I would not break it and start making him talk. So I just stood there, and after a while, he said to me, this has been the best trip we've ever been on. I said, really? Tell me about it. And he said, what was so good about it is that you didn't make me do things I didn't want to do. Now, that's not really a great trophy of tribute, but it's the best I'd gotten. And I was thrilled that I found out that at least when I'm asleep and quiet, he likes me. Now, I looked at that and I realized that the reason we got through well is because I determined not to push him and because I gave him silver boxes on the trip. And I would not only give him a silver box, but I would tell somebody something good about him when he was right within hearing distance. And then I began to hear him say some nice things about me. And now when my husband passed away and I was basically left by myself, it was this son who said to me, I want you to come and buy a house near me. My children need a grandmother. They need you. Now, see, I could have ruined it all. I could have continued being bossy, dogmatic, making fun of him, trying to tell funny stories when he didn't want to hear them. But because I decided I'd give him silver boxes and I'd try to give him words that were uplifting instead of words that were putting him down, knocking down the pile of blocks. And because of that, my son and I are really good friends today. He's not changed. He's not any different. He's still very serious. He's doing very well in business. And he is a delight in the way he cares for me. Now, tonight, there may be people that you're thinking of that need a few silver boxes. Now, as I share with you one more little story, I want to share with you about my parents. Because many of us are parents. Some of us lift up our children, some of us don't. Many of us here tonight are ones that have aging parents that are sometimes difficult to deal with. Sometimes it don't seem to appreciate what you're doing for them. And whichever way it may be, I want to share with you what happened with me and my father. My father and mother married late in life. My mother was 30 and my father was 50. Neither one had been married before. And when they got married, they were much older than most of the people in the family, and I was the first child. I was born when my father was over 50. And I remember as I grew up that I somehow didn't like the fact that my father looked older than all my friends' fathers. Those of you that marry an older man will find that you may do fine together, but somehow they'll look old to the children compared to the other ones. Now, that's not an impossibility. We did fine with that. But it is a fact of life. And so, as we were growing up, I always asked my mother to go to parent teachers because my mother looked so much younger than my father looked. And I tried to bring my mother to certain places. And I was not particularly close to my father as I was growing up. Now, when I went to college, I got a little different view. I began to realize that I was now an adult, and it really didn't matter what age my father was. So I became a little closer to him during that period of time. I remember my senior year in college, I came home for my Christmas vacation, and I was standing in the store with my father. We lived in the room, three rooms behind the store, and we ate in the store in front of the customers. And I was out in the store with my father, and I was telling him how well I was doing, and that I was still on the dean's list, and I was getting certain prizes in speech, and I was impressing him with how well I was doing in college. And after a while, he said to me, "Come in the back room, I want to show you something." And we went into the back room, and as we went in there, he reached over behind the piano. Now, the piano was a real trophy in our family because we had nothing. And in that little room, that little den, there were two pieces of furniture, the piano on one wall and a couch on the other wall, that when you opened up the couch into a hide-a-bed, you could sit on the edge of it and play the piano. And that was the size of the room. And while my father was reaching behind the piano to pull out this little box he had there, that I looked at that piano. And I realized that I had not really been singing many hymns while I was in college. I'd gone to church now and then, but I hadn't been really active. And I looked at that piano and remembered those Sunday evenings when Aunt Sadie, who was the church organist, would come into there and she would play hymns. And my brothers and I would sing the hymns. People in the store would hear us singing. And they would come in and stand around the piano. And we'd have our own private Sunday evening hymn sing. Well, I thought of that night. I thought, I haven't done that for a long time, and I'd missed it. See, I thought I was too grown up to do those things anymore. Some of us get that feeling now and then. And so while I was thinking of that, my father reached behind the piano, brought out an old cigar box. I looked at that, I'm the curious type, and I said, "What is that?" He said, "Open inside and see." So I opened inside, it was full of newspaper clippings. And I looked at them and I said, "What are these?" He said, "Read one and see." So I took the top one off and it had my father's name on the article. I said, "Did you write this?" He said, "Yes, I wrote all of them." I said, "Why didn't you tell me you could write?" See, I was always really looking for some way that I could praise him. And here he'd been writing a whole box full of clippings. So I said, "Why didn't you tell me?" He said, "Well, your mother told me that I didn't have enough education. I shouldn't try to write, because what if I wrote and it wasn't any good? We'd all be embarrassed." My mother was always afraid that we'd do something that would embarrass her. So I didn't realize she'd said that to my father, too. Don't do anything that will humiliate the family. We might all be embarrassed. I said, "So what did you do?" He said, "Well, sometimes when she would be out on an afternoon, I would write an article. I liked to write. I knew I could write. And I would write an article. I'd send it into the Boston papers. I'd watch the papers every day. We sold them in the store." And he said, "I would look there And he said, every once in a while, there would be one of my articles. And every time there was an article, I would cut it out and I'd put it in this box. And he said, I've been saving them here. He said, your mother doesn't know about this box. But he said, here, it's for you. I'd like you to have this box. This is my box of broken dreams. It's the evidence of what could have been if only someone had given me some encouraging words. Is there someone that needs your encouragement and you haven't given them encouraging words? Well, my father didn't receive the encouraging words, and he put the box back behind the piano, and he said to me as we went out, he said, don't tell your mother anything about this because she does her best living here in the store. And he said, I just don't want her to know anything about it. Now, I didn't tell her. I didn't tell her for many years. And that next morning, my mother and father went to Boston for the first day off they'd had together in many years. And as they were walking through Park Street Station in Boston, Massachusetts, my father dropped to the pavement. My mother looked down. A nurse came through the crowd, knelt down, looked up at my mother and said, he's dead. Now my mother didn't know what to do. She stood there straddled over the body until somebody came to help. She went with them to the hospital, to the morgue, came home alone on the train. We had no phone, so we didn't know. And that night she walked into the store, and she walked in alone. And we three, my two brothers and I, we looked up and we said, where's Daddy? And she just said, he's dead. At the morning of the funeral, I was going through the cards and letters that people had sent us, and I found in there a copy of our denominational magazine. And it came January the 1st. This is the day it was. It's after Christmas. And I would not have looked at this magazine as a young person, as a college person. It didn't mean anything to me at that time, excepting that my father had told me that he'd sent an article in here, and he wondered if it would be published. And I remember he said to me, like right at the end, he said, they probably won't publish it because it was too big, and they don't know me. He gave me a few excuses why it was they probably wouldn't publish this article. However, that day, the day of the funeral, that I went through this magazine, this is the actual magazine, went through the magazine, and in there, I found on the letters to the editor page, I found my father's article. It came the day of the funeral. Now, I would not have looked at that if he hadn't mentioned it to me, but the fact that he had made me realize that my father had a talent that I had never realized, that he had an ability that I had never praised him for, that he had such talent to be able to write, and to write something meaningful for more democracy was the name of the article, that I realized that my father had abilities that none of us had ever used to lift him up. Is there someone that you know, whether it's your mate, one of your children, your parents, whoever it may be, that maybe has within them some creativity? My mother was a violinist. And I remember in her last 10 years of life that she would every once in a while say, I really wish there was somewhere I could play the violin. And I would just say, there's no group around here that we could do that. And I'd kind of just put it down and move along. I look back at that now and realize I could have found some place that my mother could play. I could have done something better. I could have lifted her up. I could have given her little silver boxes with bows on top, but I didn't do it. Right now, is the Lord nudging you in any way and telling you someone that maybe not everybody likes, maybe somebody that's a little bit different, maybe somebody who doesn't do things the way you do them, but maybe in some way needs to be encouraged and lifted up? As I share this message in different places around the world, that I find people coming up to me and saying, my mother never said a kind word to me. My father never praised me at all. My grandmother was the only one who was even nice to me. And men will come up and cry over the fact that nobody ever built them up. Nobody ever lifted them up, reached out that hand, the hand with a little silver box, and gave them encouraging words. Now today, as we're together, and we've had the beautiful music this evening, and we're heading into a new week, and we know what it is to give a silver box, an encouraging word. We know that we can do that. We know that all kinds of people can give a silver box to someone else. How about you? So tonight, let's ask ourselves, as we're at this point, let's ask ourselves, do you know someone? Someone who perhaps has a song waiting to be sung? Perhaps some art waiting to be hung? Perhaps a scene waiting to be staged? Or perhaps even some friends waiting to be engaged? Do you know someone who has a tale waiting to be told? Perhaps a book waiting to be sold? Perhaps a rhyme waiting to be read? Perhaps a speech waiting to be said? Do you know someone who has God's word waiting to be shared? Or perhaps even a dream waiting to be dared? If you know someone like that, don't let them die with the music still in them. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Florence Littauer suffered a stroke on May 17, 2020, just weeks after celebrating her 92nd birthday. She fought the impacts of the stroke for weeks, but eventually she wore out. For her birthday, she received hundreds of cards with notes of how her work inspired people and influenced their life's direction. She read each and every one. During her hoped-for recovery, there were many times where we really felt she'd pull through. One day, during one of those times, I told her she was amazing. She looked at me and said, "I want to be amazing." I asked her to say it again so I could capture it on video to send to my siblings. She looked into my phone and said, "I want to be really amazing." Almost everywhere my mother spoke, Silver Boxes was part of the program. Though she wrote more than 40 books and spoke on many topics, her most popular were Silver Boxes and her teaching on the personalities. If you haven't yet listened to The Best of Personality Plus, please do. It is available free at thepersonalities.com. There, you can also shop for her books and other recordings. I think you will agree, Florence Littauer got her dying wish. She was really amazing.